Today is Tuesday, November 5th, and 2024. Welcome back, Larry.
Election Day in America.
Exactly. Let's talk about the breaking news right now. We've learned that Gallant, the defense minister of Israel, was fired by Netanyahu. What's going on in Israel, Larry, in your opinion?
I think Gallant's opposition to Netanyahu in almost every category, militarily speaking and increasingly politically speaking, finally got to Bibi. And Bibi needs some action anyway, so it coincided with his need for that. The leak, quote, leak, unquote. He's trying to deal with that. He's trying to deal with everything that surrounds that. Of course, he caused the leak. And we got to see how that works out. I have no doubt that it will probably work out ultimately to his disadvantage. But Gallant was becoming a thorn in his side. So particularly, as I understand it, over the hostage issue, Gallant was insisting on some action with regard to the few remaining hostages that we have alive, and also over the ultra-Orthodox issue, because he had started to actually enroll them to bring them into the military. And they were furious. And Ben-Gvir and that group on the cabinet were furious and threatening to break up the government. Isn't this just rich that they want to kill people left, right, front, back, sideways, and everything else, but they don't want their ultra-Orthodox to risk their lives in the combat? I mean, this is sick. This is just sick. But that's the kind of people these are. So in any event, those two issues, I think, and just the general lack of chemistry anymore between the two men, Netanyahu figured he had to get rid of him, shaking up the cabinet again. This is a favorite tactic of people who are in trouble. When they're in trouble, they do things like this, which are really meaningless, but they get the press and they get the spotlight off the principal for a few minutes. And that's what Netanyahu was looking for. He's losing. He's losing on every front. And someone said today he's fighting on three fronts. I said, are you kidding me? He just attacked Syria again. He's fighting on five fronts at a minimum. He's fighting Iran. He's fighting Hezbollah. He's fighting Hamas. He's fighting Syria. And he's fighting Iraq. I'm sorry. This guy just does not know how to do anything but expand his wars. And, of course, ultimately, his aim has still not been fulfilled. His ultimate aim is to get the United States to do his heavy lifting for him. And I think he's beginning to understand that the United States, particularly the Pentagon, and Yoav Gallant and Lloyd Austin had a decent relationship. The Pentagon does not want to take on Israel's burden. They'll fly B-52s over there, and they'll sail aircraft carriers, and they'll do all that kind of stuff. But they do not want to take on Israel's burden in fighting this war on these multiple fronts. And that's really irking him, I think.
We have what's going on in Israel is two different mindsets, Larry. Before going to the southern part of Lebanon, we knew that Gallant was against that invasion of Lebanon. It seems that he knows the capabilities of the Israeli army. But who else knows about that? Are they realistic in what they're capable of doing in the southern part of Lebanon? And how is that playing a role in this crisis in Israel?
Your point is driven home when I say that Israel Katz certainly doesn't have the experience, the new defense minister. We still have Halevi as the chief of staff. He has the experience. But they're losing their shorts in Lebanon. They've made very little progress. They've taken enormous casualties. I've pointed this out again and again to people. Yesterday, someone was telling me, well, the KIA count is down. I said, have you looked at the wounded in action count? The wounded in action count is off the charts. That's what you look at in modern war with a state like Israel or the United States or Russia, because we have such good battlefield evacuation procedures, such fast procedures, such good battlefield surgery techniques, good hospitals. And look at Israel. They're operating on maximally interior lines. They only have to evacuate them a few kilometers. So you look at the wounded in action count, and it's off the charts. You know, that's what really tells you if you're winning or losing. And these are not wounds that are just fix them and send them back to combat. These are missing arms and legs, missing other appendages. It's, you know, the wounded in action in Lebanon is really high right now. I'm hearing it's as high as 4,000. That's horrendous when you think about they've only been at it for a few weeks.
What are the repercussions coming from these, what's going on in the southern part of Lebanon within the society of Israel?
I think we're looking at, you know, there's no question in my mind that Gallant wanted to bring the Orthodox in because he's running out of soldiers. And that's an indication of what happened in Lebanon when they hit that buzzsaw. I mean, they've been losing in Gaza, no doubt about that. They've been taking a lot of hits in Gaza, but that's been going on for, it's been going on for over a year, and pretty intense combat. And it's not going away. The moment they think they've cleared a place, they move on to another place. They come back to the place they just cleared, like northern Gaza, and it's active with Hamas again. So they haven't accomplished even that strategic objective to eliminate Hamas. In fact, quite the contrary. I'm hearing that the recruiting for Hamas is off the charts, that they have so many people they can't train them fast enough. So you've probably got people coming in from the outside too. You've probably got Palestinians coming in from Jordan. You've probably got Palestinians coming in from Egypt. I wouldn't doubt that for a minute. Young men and young women coming in and volunteering. As I mentioned earlier in a previous interview, I think I'm hearing from Tunisia, all the way to the I heard even in Turkey there are young men and young women who want to volunteer to go down and help in Gaza, help Hamas in Gaza. So there's no shortage of recruits for Hamas. So he hasn't accomplished that objective. And now we're looking at Lebanon being very rapidly a worse situation than Gaza in terms of casualties and no progress being made. So he's fighting on two fronts in which he's losing fairly majorly. And I haven't even talked about the front that he really wants to focus on, and that's Iran. And he took it in the shorts with this last attack that Israel tried to conduct on Iran. Propaganda from Israel, propaganda from Europe, propaganda from our country, America, is saying the opposite. You got generals out there saying the opposite. But it's absurd. Show me the satellite imagery. Bibi, show me the battle damage. Show me the pictures. Show me the proof, because there isn't any. And I've seen some things that dispute that there is some. And these are pretty good high-resolution satellite photographs. So is Iran going to hit them back now? And my calculation has been all along that Iran does not want a war with the United States, and that they deemed a really crushing attack on Israel, which they could administer at any moment, would invite the United States into the war. And so they weren't going to do that. I'm hearing now that there's been a pretty good debate in Tehran, and that maybe the debate has been settled, and it was settled on the side of another attack on Israel, which will be devastating. My question then is, and I know our B-52s, our carrier movement, everything we've done is to try to preclude that, was to try to influence Iran to make the decision that it was over in terms of tit for tat, that there weren't going to be any more attacks. Everything was even. If it's true that Iran is going to hit Israel again and do so devastatingly, then I'm worried again about us entering the conflict, because Nima, us entering the conflict is certainly going to deepen and widen it, no question about it. But it's going to be our nemesis, because we cannot beat Iran.
Larry, the president of Iran, he said something so amazing, that if we can achieve something for Gazans, for Palestinians, or even in the southern part of Lebanon, they may reconsider the decision to attack Israel, to respond to Israel. I think this is huge. We can just, the United States, is there anybody in the United States considering that?
I would like to think that our principal diplomat and negotiator, William Burns, that's an absurd thing for me to say, but that's the truth, is doing something like that right now, or trying to effect something like that right now. It's certainly not Blinken. Blinken is incapable of doing it. Blinken is essentially Netanyahu's lawyer. And I think Iran knows that. I don't even think Iran would talk to Blinken. I don't think they'd talk to Sullivan either. Burns is probably, I don't even know if they'll talk to Bill, but he's probably the only one that will. Last night, Nima, I don't know if it's a Russian propaganda move, a Chinese propaganda move, or genuine. But on Twitter last night, there was a protestation by a high-level CIA agent that rang so true to my ears and to the ears of all those with whom I now today associate with regard to Ukraine, with regard to Gaza, and with regard to the lies that the West is telling, with regard to the lies that the CIA is ginning up for Zelensky in Ukraine, and the lies that we're ginning up with regard to Netanyahu and what's going on in Israel and the Levant. If it's a true picture of what this high-level CIA individual believes, then we are in deep kimchi. I mean, we're in trouble. We've got, again, and I found this phenomenon when I was working with the CIA in two different ways. One, when I was working indirectly with them at U.S. Pacific Command, when we were working on what then was Ronald Reagan's first term buildup in defense capabilities, the largest, in some respects, the largest defense buildup since World War II for the United States, 1981 to 1984. It included Star Wars and all that. I knew that in the bowels of the CIA, in the trenches where the Sovietologists really meant something, they were saying the Soviet Union was on its last legs. Fancy that. 10 years later, they fell apart. They were saying it was over for the Soviet Union. Well, Bob Gates, yes, Bob Gates, he of Call of Duty, he of the book, he of the Secretary of Defense later on, Bob Gates joined with Bill Casey, who was then Ronald Reagan's director of the CIA, and they created out of whole cloth a 10-foot-tall Soviet Union in order to support that buildup Ronald Reagan wanted to create. All lies. Fast forward. I'm at the UN by February 2003, and I'm lying, or my boss is lying with my help. Same CIA. So all this to tell you that what this man said, or woman, I don't know, there's no name associated with it, on this message delivered last night on Twitter, rang a bell with me. Yeah, we're taking intelligence that is more or less right, more or less accurate, and we're crafting it and twisting it and bending it to fit the policy of Russia's losing in Ukraine and Bibi's winning in Israel. That's what we're doing. That's what this message said. And he essentially said, I'm out of here. I'm gone. Now, I don't know how to check on it. He did mention someone in the text, someone whom I know. He mentioned by name someone in the text with whom he had confided. And so I'm going to call this individual because I know him and I can talk to him and ask him, was this a genuine document? Now, don't expect him to tell me the man's name, because I wouldn't if I were he, because obviously he doesn't want to know, want people to know who he is yet anyway. But if it's a legitimate cri de coeur from the CIA, from the bowels of the CIA, here we are a third time doing this. A third time we've got analysts in the CIA doing their job in the trenches, telling the truth. Ukraine is losing. Russia is winning. Bibi's in trouble. Bibi's in big trouble. Bibi's in desperate trouble. And the higher ups are twisting it. And I got to include in that higher ups, Bill Burns. And that really troubles me because I thought Burns was an adult in a bunch of insane children. So I'm worried right now. I'm really worried that we're not getting the straight picture, even inside the government. This would explain to me why Biden seems to be such a cretin. It would explain to me why Biden seems to make all the wrong decisions, because he's getting intelligence fabricated by whomever, the neoconservatives, whomever, that's feeding into him, and he's going on that intelligence. How can you listen to these generals, for example, who are out there talking about how Ukraine is taking so few casualties and Russia is taking so many casualties, when it's exactly the opposite? And these guys in the bowels of the CIA, the ones doing the real work, are probably reporting that. So who is turning it around and feeding it to President Biden as the exact opposite? That's a hell of a question right now.
Do you think these people who are talking about this on Twitter, they cannot, they have no mean to inform the president? That's why they're putting out on Twitter? And
I got to assume that's part of it. When you talk about informing the president, you really only have two ways. Well, there are three or four ways, but two distinct ways. One is the presidential daily brief, where the briefer goes in every day with a briefcase and briefs the president on the intelligence of the day. And if the president says, I want to know more about Ukraine, or I want to know more about Israel or whatever, then that will be the next day's brief. Or it can be an instant brief if he wants it right away, and it can be prepared. That's one way. That's the formal way. And I'll tell you what Colin Powell used to say about that, because every now and then he would get that brief. He would say, that's dog shit. That's what he would say. He would say, these people come in and they brief you, and you can tell them you read it in the funny books last night. You know, what they reported is finished intelligence many times. So he would always make a specific request. I don't want that garbage with all the Hollywood pictures and everything. I want you to tell me what that man is planning to do, or what that woman is planning to do. I want you to tell me what their capabilities to do it are. Don't give me the hogwash, the pretty things and the, you know, photographs. But that's one way. The second way is you've got to get around the leadership. Because the leadership has determined, for whatever reason, that the president wants A, B, and C, and not D, E, and F, the president's going to get A, B, and C, even though D, E, and F are being briefed in the bowels of the CIA. Very dangerous situation. I saw it twice. I saw it with Ronald Reagan from my position out in the Pacific, and I saw it up close and personal with George W. Bush, Iraq, George Tenet, John McLaughlin, the CIA, and the people underneath who were telling the truth about Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction, for example, but couldn't even get through to the Secretary of State because Tenet kept them away. Is someone doing that now? Are there people in the CIA who know how badly Ukraine is losing? Got to be. Got to be. They're over there. They've got to be. Why doesn't Biden understand it? There's another possibility, of course. Biden is being briefed accurately, and he just doesn't want to, for political reasons, whatever, he just doesn't want to. I can understand that given the election coming up and so forth, but I can't understand it to the degree of insanity that I'm seeing. So I've got to believe that this little note last night is an indicator that no one is listening to the real experts in the CIA. Instead, the politicians at the top of the CIA are turning it around and giving the president what they sense the president wants.
Larry, if you were to draw a picture which shows that how much leverage does Israel have on Pentagon and CIA, how would you draw that picture?
I would say that the leverage they have on the CIA is vividly described in a very microcosmic way, but nonetheless illustrative in Gary Vogler's book that just came out. Here it is right here. Israel, winner of the 2003 Iraq oil war. Gary was our man in Iraq. He was there for 75, 76 months. He came out of the U.S. oil business, Mobil Oil, as I recall, before they merged with Exxon, and very, very qualified, capable guy, West Point graduate. And he went to Iraq and stayed there for 6 years as our oil man in Iraq. Came out and wrote this book. He also wrote another book called Iraq and the Politics of Oil, bigger one than this one. But this one is the revelation that occurred to him after he had written the first one and did some more research. Because the first one said it really wasn't about oil. There were some oil matters that were sensitive and they were on the fringes, but what it was about was other things. It wasn't about oil. Then he wrote this book after he did some more research. It was about oil for Israel. And you have to read the book to understand how complex that really is. But the Iraq war, to a large extent, for Paul Wolfowitz, Deputy Secretary of Defense, and Douglas Feith, Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, the Iraq war was about oil for Israel. Discounted price oil for Israel. Great book. Every American should read it. So when you come back to the basics again, and you ask yourself, how does the CIA, having dealt in this book with Mossad in a very duplicitous way, very duplicitous, doing whatever Mossad wanted him to do whenever they wanted him to do it? And that's not the men and women in the rank and file in the CIA. That's George Tenet, John McLaughlin, and a few other people at the top of the CIA. But they're the ones who tell the president the message. So it doesn't matter what the good guys are doing and gals are doing in the bottom of the CIA if the top is corrupt. I think the top is glued to Mossad and Mossad glued to it, just as in this book. Mossad occupied the Undersecretary of Defense's policy, Douglas Feith's office, 24/7. The Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, came out one day, looked down the hall, and said, "I don't run this building. Israel does." And he was right. They were dictating to the number three man in the Pentagon what they wanted to happen in Iraq. There's your answer to your question about the relationship between the CIA and the Mossad. It's not down at the bowel. You know, it's not down in the trenches. It's up there at the top. It's the political types and the quasi-political types at the top of the agency. Same with Mossad, I suspect. There are probably agents in Mossad who are good intelligence officers, but they get corrupt. Their information, like for right now, am I winning? What do you think they're saying? What do you think those guys down in the trenches of Mossad are saying about whether or not in Gaza and Lebanon against Iran and so forth, Israel is even keeping its head above water? I imagine they're presenting a pretty dire picture, but it's not a dire picture that makes its way to Netanyahu. Or if it does, it's completely blacked out by him, and he's got plenty of people around him to squelch that picture. That happens in every intelligence agency in the world. I mean, it happened big time with Stalin and the NKVD, for example. you could ask yourself if the ruthlessness of Stalin was not part of the reason that the Soviets took such a beating in the opening days of the German invasion of Russia, because Stalin had so corrupted his intelligence circuits that they were no longer performing the way they should. And that's what you do when you do these sorts of things. You ruin your good intelligence. You ruin it. You dampen the desire and the energy and the talent necessary to get that up to you if you refuse to take it and you just keep spending the intelligence to meet your political reasons. The British had a great phrase for what we did in 2003. I think it was the head of MI6. He said, the Americans are spinning the intelligence to fit their policy.
Yeah. In terms of Ukraine, we know that Pentagon said, no, we're not going to send long-range missiles to Ukraine. But how about Israel? How about the leverage the Israeli government has on Pentagon? How do you see that?
Well, here's the thing that's happening, Nima, and this is a shock to the Pentagon, I'll guarantee you, if they're accepting it. And my information tells me some of them are. What they're learning is that Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Grumman, and a host of other defense contractors have been lying to them about the quality and the technological art that they present to the Pentagon. Russia's stuff is better than ours. China's stuff is better than ours. That's what they're learning. And they're learning it principally through these two conflicts. And granted, conflict produces far better equipment because you evolve day after day after day. You learn. Your drones get better. Your missiles get better. Your air defense gets better. Your radars get better. If you're not in that cauldron of combat, you don't have any pressure to get better. And look at what we've been doing for the last 24, 25 years. We haven't fought a real war since the Gulf War, the first Gulf War in 1990 and 91. And that we just ran away with. Why did we just run away with it? Well, partly because Saddam was not all that good. The Iranians had already proven that. They were knocking at the door of Baghdad. Remember that? And partly because we had peaked. We had peaked in production. We had peaked in technology. We had peaked in capability. We had peaked in training, everything. And so we kind of walked over Iraq in that war. We've been going downhill ever since. And we've really been going downhill with the defense contractors who price gouge, who monopolize, who limit the workforce to make more money off of them. I mean, we aren't producing top drawer equipment, and particularly not top drawer air defense equipment. We have discovered that the Russian equipment being provided to their proxies, if you will, in Iran's case, they're an ally now. I think they inked that treaty. At least I heard yesterday that they have inked that treaty. Putin finally signed his side of the bargain. So they're getting Russian and Chinese equipment, and it's better than ours. So that's a long way of going to the story that the Pentagon does not want to fight. They do not want to fight. They know that at best it'll be a draw, and they might lose. Now, they've done nothing for the past 15 years but propagandize the American people at football games, baseball games, flyovers, and everything else, that we are the greatest freaking military on the face of the earth, that no one can stand up to us. Imagine how they must feel now, seeing the battlefield results from Ukraine and the Middle East.
How much of what has happened to Pentagon, Larry, that you've just mentioned is the product of what the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan? Because these two wars has shaped in some way or another way the defense capabilities of the United States.
Yes, no question about it. It's almost the same with Israel. Israel's been on occupation duty for 20 plus years. That's not war fighting. That's not the battlefield. That's the place where you butt stroke any innocent civilians. You bayonet babies. You do all manner of stuff when you're on occupation duty. And Israel was doing all of that. Some of the things they did were as bad as anything they've done in Gaza. They just weren't wholesale like they are now. We were doing the same thing in Afghanistan and the same thing in Iraq in many respects. What was the most effective weapon against us in both theaters? Improved explosive devices. I run out, I get myself a battery, I get myself a cell phone, I get myself your 155 artillery round that you left lying around. I wire that baby, I dig a little hole in the road, I wire it, put it in the hole. You drive your Humvee over it. I use my cell phone and set it off. I kill three of your people and wound two more. That was the major way the Taliban and the Sunnis in Iraq put casualties on us. Improvised explosive devices. I mean, IEDs.
Do you think that right now, with the reality of what's going on in the Middle East, is there any sort of serious communication, as you've mentioned, about the CIA person who was putting out something on Twitter? Do you think these information are getting to the head of, I don't know, Israeli government, to Netanyahu? Are they informed about it?
I seriously doubt it. And even if it were, Nima, I don't think he'd listen. It doesn't fit his political needs. Just as I don't think George Bush, you may recall that we did have an Iraqi very close to Saddam come to the United States, and he asked for an audience, and at least we gave him an audience. And he essentially said, Saddam does not have any weapons of mass destruction. And he was willing to go back to Iraq, get a signed letter from Saddam. He was willing to take anybody with him to Iraq and walk them around and show them. He even talked to Hans Blix, as I recall, the head of the weapons inspectors, who was itching to go back to Iraq, who told Colin Powell, you give me 30 days over there and I'll give you 90% assurance as to whether or not he has them. And of course, Dick Cheney went out then and blew the whole thing out of the water because he knew that if Hans Blix got over there, he would do just that and there would be no war. So I've got to assume that if anybody's carrying a package of intelligence that refutes the beliefs of Bibi Netanyahu, they can't get across his threshold.
Larry, you've mentioned the main reason, this book that you showed us about the price of oil was one of the main reasons of the war in Iraq. It seems that in the mind of Netanyahu and his administration in those days, they thought that if we overthrow the government in Iraq, we are capable of doing the same thing in Iran. And on the other hand, how do you see the way that they saw Iraq in those days? Did they have any sort of fear from Iraq threatening them? Or it was just all about oil?
Well, the very first country that Israel's intelligence, Mossad, declared Israel's number one enemy was Iraq. And this came out of the experience of the armored attacks that were generated in the 67 war and then the 73 war. Now, I think after the 73 war, because of what Sadat, and Sadat was trying to do this. I think Sadat was not at any time trying to overthrow the state of Israel. What he was trying to do was establish himself as the army in the Arab world that could duke it out with Israel on an even keel. That's all he wanted to do. He didn't want to take Israel. He didn't want to take Tel Aviv. He just wanted to prove that he could do that. And Carter was smart enough to wade into that and understand that he'd done just that. And therefore, there could be a peace treaty. And that was the beginning of a lot of euphoria that we would, in fact, move towards a two-state solution because we had one of the major parties having proved himself against the Israeli juggernaut, stood his own ground, and now we had peace between them. So it shifted from Iraq to Egypt. But Iraq was always, you know, out there. The Arab state with all those tanks and all that Russian equipment, all that artillery and everything. And that's one of the reasons H.W. Bush had a real hard time restraining Israel during the first Gulf War, because they wanted to go. They wanted to go. They wanted to make sure they helped take out Iraq. That atrophied after they saw how quickly Saddam was defeated. His vaunted Republican Guard was defeated in, what, 19 hours by air attacks and in a couple of weeks and ground attacks so badly that George Bush said, stop it. George H.W. Bush said, stop it. Don't kill any more Iraqis. Then it shifted to Iran. Now, this is a very convoluted story because during the Iran-Iraq War, one of the bloodiest wars that region had ever seen. I mean, they've seen lots of war. Alexander the Great, you know, that was a bloody war. The so-called War of the Cities, they were shooting missiles at each other's cities every day, back and forth. And Iraq blitzkrieged them. I mean, they pushed right into Iran. They made 30, 40 kilometers the first day. They were going. They were going. Then what happened? Iran mustered its millions, put 17-year-olds, 16-year-olds in the front lines. Saddam even went to chemical weapons, which we gave him. He used chemical weapons on the Iranians. To the Iranians' credit, they would not respond. There is no evidence whatsoever that the Iranians responded with chemical weapons anytime during that war. You could say they had every right to in terms of what had happened to them, but they didn't. They inexorably pushed their way. And why did we finally get the UN and the declaration of the war should stop to really take effect? Because we didn't want them going to Baghdad, because we knew they were going to Baghdad. And then it would be Iran having Iraq. And it'd be two countries that were very dangerous. That is why I say we don't need to fight Iran. How many people in Iraq at that time? I think if I remember right, it was somewhere between 25 and 30 million. Iran's about 90 million now. How homogeneous was Iraq? Well, just look at the Sunni-Shia divide and you say it wasn't homogeneous. Iran is 53, 54% Persian. It's got some problems around the periphery, no question about it. But that basic core of people is solid. That's a different country. That's a different war, different terrain, different geography. You don't do the air war that we did in Iraq in 19 hours in Iran. You just don't. Ask the Israelis who just found out how hard it is. It's a different, whole different ballgame. And you're right. Our skills have atrophied majorly. Clearly, the IDF skills at this kind of warfare have atrophied majorly. And we're going to take on Iran? I don't think so. I don't think so. Not without a lot of blood, a lot of treasure, a lot of years, and not much to show for it at the end of a decade of fighting. A decade that might see the empire collapse. Let's face it. We've got real deep physical problems. Deep physical problems. Pentagon, the only sane place in the government right now. Back to the question you asked, the Pentagon is saying, we do not want that. We do not want that. We'll fly B-52s over there. By the way, if we flew a B-52 over Iran, they'd shoot it down in about 5 minutes. That's just a show of force. Nima, I'm afraid that if we sailed a carrier really, really close in harm's way and with intent to do harm, we'd lose the carrier or two. You want to wake up to modern warfare? You want to wake up to what the Ukrainians wake up to every morning, to what increasingly Israel is waking up to, especially in Lebanon? Take on Iran and be embarrassed as hell. And what scares me about that, Nima, is that the American empire doesn't do embarrassment well. What it will do is kick the war up. What it will do is go to its fail-safe weaponry. And you know what that is.
Seems to me, Larry, with all that said, whenever in Iraq, in Gaza, in Lebanon, Israel is defeating itself.
Yes.
They're not defeating anybody. Even with Iraq, the way that the United States, with the war in Iraq, they removed the government. Right now, the government is totally in line with Iran. And they're making new enemies. They're making new battlegrounds that they're not capable of fighting against.
And there was no love between the Persians and the Arabs in Iraq. No love, Shia or Sunni. Not really. I mean, there were a few clerics that had, you know, affiliations with Iranian clerics and vice versa. And so there were those connections. I remember Muqtada al-Sadr had a conversation with us about that one day. My son in the Air Force was in Kirkuk for 6 months flying with the Iraqi Air Force. And this was some of the better quality Iraqi soldiers in their, I think it was the 12th Air Force, 12th Iraqi Air Force flying out of Kirkuk. And my son said, anytime they would go have a beer together or sit down in a PX-like facility or whatever, the first thing the Iraqis would talk about was how they hated the Persians, the Iranians. And he had no doubt that if he were on the other side of the border, they would say the same thing about the Iraqis, Sunni or Shia. And what we did was force them together now. We forced them together to a certain extent.
We've learned, Larry, that after bombing many villages, towns in the southern part of Lebanon, Israel is pulling out several brigades. And do you think they're pulling these brigades out of southern Lebanon just to take some rest and send new people there, or they're just getting out of the southern Lebanon?
I think they're getting out of southern Lebanon. They may go, they may try to penetrate somewhere else where it's not quite so, shall we say, festooned with Hezbollah fighters. But I don't think so. I think they'll do what they normally do. They'll back up, they'll use their air power, and they'll kill civilians and bomb civilian infrastructure. They will, quote, teach the Lebanese a lesson, unquote. I think that's probably what they'll do. Now, what are they going to do about all the Israelis who are leaving? I dare say, adding to the some million I'm told, who've already left, gone to Europe, come to America, whatever, that those who were going back to their homes in the north aren't. And so they may be the next tranche to leave. And they may drag some others with them as they go. Bibi Netanyahu may be presiding over a disappearing state.
Right now we're having the U.S. presidential election. Two candidates, Kamala Harris and Donald Trump.
Oh, no, there's more. There's Jill Stein. And
Jill Stein, yeah. Cornel West, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Do you think that at the end of the day, does it matter who's gonna win in the U.S. in 2024 presidential election in terms of the future of Israel and what they're doing in that region?
Actually, I think it does. I think it matters in some domestic ways that are powerfully different. But I think it matters with regard to Israel, too, because Donald Trump and Jared Kushner and that whole gang have shown that their entire motivation is money. And that means they can deal with Mohammed bin Salman, Mohammed bin Zayed, whomever on that side of the Gulf, and they can deal with Israel and others on the other side of the Gulf, as they will deal with them and as Israel wants to deal with them, which is to kill them, get rid of them, exterminate the Persians. I think Trump will go right along with that. He'll stand there and cheer for that. So Netanyahu is probably praying Trump is elected.
Yeah. Just to wrap it up, Larry, right now with the situation in Ukraine, we've learned that New York Times is talking about that Ukraine.
Finally, it penetrated.
What's happening, Larry? Why are they talking about this right now?
Here's what I think, and this is a surmise on my part, but I've talked to a couple of editorial staff, and I happen to know a guy who's, well, I won't say anything about that. Anyway, he's dating one of the high-level people. I think they cut back on their international staff so dramatically over the last 10 to 15 years that they have no real on-the-ground credibility, period. And when they're not stupid, though. And so the few people that they do have looking out over the horizon, as it were, when they see alternative media, they look at alternative media, too. When they see the buzz out there that's so counter to what they're getting in their pabulum, they go inspecting and they check around and they call, and they, you know, they call Istanbul, they call Beirut, they call Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, wherever, and they ask questions. And they finally have a few people who've gotten answers to those questions that they had a difficult time discounting. And so now they're reexamining some of their lines. And you're going to see more of that coming out. I think that's the simplicity of it, that they simply cut back so badly. The LA Times was one of the best newspapers in America for reporting on the Pacific region. I used to read it every morning when I was at Pacific Command. They don't even have an international staff anymore, Nima. They cut back so dramatically to save money because they were getting so much pressure from alternative media and such, you know, and they went online themselves and they cut all that staff out. So they don't have any experts anymore. They have no one on the LA Times who could tell you where Indonesia is. And that's a disservice to the American people, but it's a product of our capitalist system.
Is that a good sign for the next president of the United States? No matter who's going to win, we're going to have some sort of off-ramp in Ukraine.
I certainly hope so. You know, I can't believe these freaking generals are retired, all of them retired, out there still talking about it, because they're making money off the military defense contractors that they're working for. They're making money off Ukraine, so they don't want to see it stop. They know that it's being lost. They can't be that stupid. Just looking at the casualty count, I mean, it's so one-sided now. And we're saying it's not, but it is, and any fool can tell it is. It's probably 10 to 1 now. And Ukraine is falling apart at the front lines. I mean, they're collapsing. They don't have enough men. They don't have enough women. They don't have enough people, period. They're just collapsing. I have some problem with this business of 10,000 Koreans and such. Putin is usually smarter than that, so I have a real difficult time. I'm going to have to see some pictures of them on the battlefield before I believe, because why would you want to do that? Why would you want to complicate a victory you've already made complete, pretty much? And that just seems to me like throwing sand in the defeated person's face that doesn't need to be thrown in his face. So maybe that's just a bunch of propaganda. I don't know. I've found no one yet to confirm for me that there really are Koreans. Yeah. Just like no one can confirm for me the damage that Bibi Netanyahu says was done to him.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Larry, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Take care.
Take care.
Bye-bye. See you.
See you.